You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 9th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. We are broadcasting from our respective quarantine locations, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report, Michael Thursday. Joining us on this week's program, on today's program, I should say, Rob Larson, talking about the myth of Bill Gates, why his philanthropic giving is a racket. I might even get to a Jeffrey Epstein question as we talk with Larson about what Bill Gates is really up to. The economy continues to crater. We are now up to 16 million unemployment claims, 3 weeks into the acceleration of Corona ravaging the economy and, of course, taking many lives. Wall Street, they were scared as hell of Bernie Sanders. Stock markets surges 700 points after Bernie suspends his campaign. Good reminder that these folks are opposed to your well-being and interests. Biden and Sanders working towards a truce on major issues. What does that actually mean? Officials in at least six states are accusing the federal government of quietly diverting their orders for Corona medical equipment. And the oversight and an oversight panel claims that the Trump administration didn't distribute stockpiles based on states' needs. I wonder what other metrics the Trump administration might be using. Federal government is also going to now be ending support for Corona testing sites as the peak nears, at least in some places. Trump preparing to unveil a second Corona task force. Probably some interesting entrepreneurial opportunities there. And as coronavirus spread, a financial services contractor told warehouse workers they weren't allowed to get sick. As another example of this murderous effects of this virus on working people, President Lula has condemned President Jair Bolsonaro's relentless irresponsibility in the face of Corona. And a Saudi-led coalition announces a ceasefire in their five-year bombardment of Yemen. And GOP Senator Kelly Loeffler is going to sell off all individual stocks after the Corona trade backlash. All right, fine. I won't do business anymore. And most Corona cases in New York came from Europe. As Jerry Falwell Jr. says, warrants are out for two journalists after stories critical of his Corona decision, I think, to open Liberty University. Reminds us of the old Bill O'Reilly Fox News security thing. I was going to make a Cabana joke, but whatever. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. We'll get to Professor Larson shortly. I'm, of course, here with Matt Leck and Brendan Finn. Sam is doing one of the high holy days that I am such a mensch that I'm willing to negate half of my identity so that Sam can pour some Manischewitz on himself. That's been this way for a long time. Jamie and Nomiki will join us for a bit in the fun half. Bernie Sanders dropped out We analyzed it yesterday. We've all been talking on our various platforms. We did two streams on TMBS that folks should check out. It's sad, very sad. I'll kind of confess that I went through my own grieving process. I mean, you know, there was this maybe some hope of a miracle in Michigan, but after Super Tuesday, I mean, this was pretty much over. So I guess I had already sort of come to some terms with it. And now we're kind of analyzing what is the actual long-term implications of this campaign. And I think honestly, we cannot be Pollyannish. We can't tell bedtime stories. We can't flinch from defeat, from failure. We can't look away from mistakes that were made. And we have to be deeply honest about the state of the Democratic Party and about where the left actually is. And I think a lot of those answers are not what we would want them to be right now. And at the same time, there's just no question that Bernie Sanders' leadership, as well as a variety of other factors, some good, some very bad. There's plenty of people getting radicalized right now. And I don't want anybody to get radicalized this way because this is horrible. But it's happening. Those kind of ridiculous talking points against single payer are like, oh, a lot of people like their job healthcare. Well, how about millions are losing it right now? And the next bailout package, most Democrats and the Republicans, I think, will work hard to do a bailout package for insurance companies instead of just providing every American healthcare. So things are changing. Bernie Sanders' leadership is essential in that. He carried clearly and bravely and with a very basic and solid humanity, a social democratic message that makes him the best leader of the time, that makes him somebody that we all should appreciate. We can critique and question and so on. But Bernie's put a lot on the board for us, and I honor him for that 100%. And he's also still making a very dopey man worried. This is Brian Kilmeade on Fox News. And let me tell you something. Brian is scared.
Decided I can't win, I can't campaign, so I'm going to quit but hold on to my delegates. Let's listen to what Bernie Sanders wants from Joe Biden going forward.
Today, I congratulate Joe Biden, a very decent man, who I will work with to move our progressive ideas forward. On a practical note, let me also say this. I will stay on the ballot in all remaining states and continue to gather delegates. While Vice President Biden will be the nominee, we must continue working to assemble as many delegates as possible at the Democratic Convention, where we will be able to exert significant influence over the party platform and other functions.
Hello, socialism. It's not goodbye. Kevin, real quick, last night on Stephen Colbert last night, he came out and said Joe Biden's got to advance, open up a circle. He's got to get more progressives around him. So hello, $15 minimum wage. Hello, Medicare for all. And goodbye, oil and gas, because fracking is now banned. If he gets his way and has legitimate influence with Joe Biden, your thoughts?
Yeah, so Bernie Sanders may be suspending his campaign, but his socialist ideas continue to live on, and they seem to be embraced more each day by Joe Biden. Yet here we are in this coronavirus where the U.S. was one of the best prepared nations in the world to handle this. But when President Trump realized that we needed a partnership, it was private business, the road to the rescue with the new testing, gearing up the new production, bringing the innovation and the solutions to the table. It's been that partnership. If we had been limited just by a one-size-fits-all national government, frankly, we wouldn't have the hope we're starting to see today in our local community. So socialism is being proven not to work as we speak. But Joe Biden continues to embrace more and more of it. I'll tell you, that's not going to go well in Texas.
Oh, my God. All right. So first of all, there is no better advocate. Like, I don't know what world they're living in, but that's a better case for Joe Biden than anything I'm seeing from any resistance person. It reminds me of how, you know, back in the day, you could read some profile of some Democratic political consultant or some, you know, some corporate hack aligned with the Democratic Party or some, you know, mediocre shitbag Democratic politician in the National Review or something. And halfway through it, you'd go like, my God, maybe this person is a secret Sandinista. I had no idea their politics were so intelligent and dynamic. Again, you know, I want to warn folks because there is a tendency, and this is what happens if you watch Tucker. This is what happens if you check out what someone like Josh Hawley is doing, actually even Marco Rubio. There is a very smart Republican move in the so-called populist direction around small business, around supply chains. And this is a very dangerous formulation in politics because a hard right social position and a more economically moderate sort of quasi-populist one could be an extremely effective formula. That's what we saw in 2016. So I don't want to get complacent. Those are where the danger signs are, and those folks are much smarter than the, you know, mainstream of the Democratic Party, and they're very dangerous. But this is the easy stuff right here. You know, just some moon-faced dope from Texas just talking nonsense. Like, the United States is in a horrifying situation with corona. There are a massive amount of unnecessary deaths have already occurred. The government is giving itself, the Trump administration is giving itself basically such a tremendous latitude in metrics that they can define success in a way that a couple hundred thousand people who did not need to die could die. And we all know that the most successful places in the world, most particularly South Korea, they have one of these things. They have a one-size-fits-all. They have a beyond Medicare for all system, which incidentally includes, as Ben Burgess pointed out to me, because he's taught in South Carolina, South Korea, you're covered even if you're not a South Korean citizen. So every model we have, Costa Rica is doing the best in Latin America. What does Costa Rica have? Better healthcare than the United States, a socialized system. So, you know, it's funny to watch, you know, Fox do, you know, the silly old delusional libertarian song and dance. And it's a good reminder, too, that despite some of the rhetoric from the Trump world, that's still basically what's driving the Republican Party, even as we have to look at the horizon and folks like Hawley, who are going to be, you know, that need to be defeated and are much and might be bringing a much different proposition to it. But the basic libertarian corporate Republican death cult continues. And it would be hysterical if it wasn't so murderous. And it's always embarrassing. I know Brendan had a different perspective. Brendan, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, you know, I think the private public partnership has been great.
It's just, I love it's like literally like it sounds like okay, the private public partnership where Donald Trump pleads with the CEO of pharmacy chains to deploy some proprietary test, or we can't take things from testing kits that have been developed in other countries as an example.
Also, it should be the fight for 20 now.
Yeah, I would say actually the fight for 30, frankly.
Sure.
And there absolutely needs to be a universal $2,000 a month UBI for at least a year.
Yep.
At least a year. And then I would say that we stick with the UBI, but it's on top of Medicare for all, robust public housing, obviously rent control, and a whole other set of policies that it can fit inside, so it doesn't just, you know, undermine the already meager social safety net and get sucked up by landlords.
You leave the rentier or rentiers, leave them on deep freeze. They don't come back from this.
They don't come back from this. Absolutely. And that's also, by the way, a compelling argument to small businesses. I think that there is a and regional economies. I actually think there's a really good crossover case there with some potentially really smart politics. Today's show is brought to you by Blinkist. Even if you're in a quarantine, it can still be hard to find time to sit down and read. But there is an app called Blinkist that will be your new secret weapon for learning things and getting ahead. Blinkist takes the best takeaways, the need-to-know information, from thousands of nonfiction books and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to on your phone, tablet, or web browser. Blinkist is made for busy people who want to get to the main points of the book quickly. They make it easy to finish during your commute, on your lunch break, or while you exercise. I have used Blinkist, you know, again, it's just for the books that you're not going to plow all the way through, but you need to keep, you know, in touch with either, say, a book like even, you know, something like The Becoming by Michelle Obama. I'm not going to read all of that, but it's something actually important. This is an important national figure. You want to know the takeaway. For the record, former British Prime Minister David Cameron, who went from being, you know, one of the world's premier trust fund babies and then giving us Brexit. That's fun. I want to know some anecdotes from that book. And then also books like The 4-Hour Workweek and others that you just want to kind of get the key information from.
They've also got Capital in the 21st Century. Piketty's book was one of the first things I ever tested Blinkist with.
Wow. Actually,
yeah.
That's interesting because that's like on the other end. That's just like a really interesting, really important book, and it's very ambitious.
But Blinkist is also, you might want to refresh yourself as to, like, you read it years ago, you can get the that sort of thing.
Exactly. Or you might want to read Blinkist first and then read the whole book, or, you know, just get the key takeaways. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all for one low price. For a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report to try it for free for 7 days. Save 25% off your subscription. That's Blinkist.com/majority report to start your free 7-day trial and save 25%. Sign up to Blinkist.com/majority report. All right, folks, we are going to take a brief break and we're going to come back. Are we going to take a break? Okay, we're going to take a brief break. We'll come back with Rob Larson. He's a professor of economics at Tacoma Community College and the author of a great new piece in Jackman, Bill Gates' Philanthropic Giving is a Racket. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Rob Larson. He's a professor of economics at Tacoma Community College. He's the author of Bit Tyrants, The Political Economy of Silicon Valley, out from Haymarket Books. His recent excellent new piece in the Jacobin magazine is called Bill Gates' Philanthropic Giving is a Racket. Full disclosure, I'm co-hosting a new show that's launching this Saturday for Jacobin with Anna Kasparian. So I guess I have to say that. Rob, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm great, Michael. My pleasure.
So actually, Rob, I do want to start with this real quick. This is a piece from November 26, 2019 in the New York Times. And it is entitled, Bill Gates Met with Jeffrey Epstein Many Times Despite His Past. I like to, like, past is, you know, let's be really specific here. This isn't somebody who, you know, I don't know, said something controversial or whatever. This is like we know what Jeffrey Epstein's past was. I mean, this is some of the most evil stuff on earth. And I'll just quote really quick. In fact, beginning in 2011, Mr. Gates met with Mr. Epstein on numerous occasions, including three times at Mr. Epstein's palatial Manhattan townhouse, and at least once staying late into the night. Employees of Mr. Gates' foundation paid multiple visits to Mr. Epstein's mansion. Here is a quote. His lifestyle is very different and kind of intriguing, although it would not work for me, Mr. Gates emailed a colleague in 2011 after his first get-together with Mr. Epstein. I bring that up because I think we should bring that up. Everybody's like Bill Gates's or Donald Trump or the Clintons' association with Jeffrey Epstein or Wexner. But in light of the fact that Bill Gates has managed, and this is what your piece gets into, totally rebrand his public image because of this philanthropy game, and that that's actually a significant way that Jeffrey Epstein laundered himself too. That famous sinister flight to Africa with Clinton and Kevin Spacey was reported contemporaneously as a kind of freewheeling, cool, charitable mission. So big picture, how is philanthropy used to launder the evils of capitalism and its ruling classes?
Yeah, I guess the answer is pretty extensively. That's what you discover when you get into this. Yeah, Epstein's kind of special role in the recent history of the American elite is really fascinating, as you said, from the Clintons to the Trumps to, indeed, other billionaires like Bill Gates himself, all the way up to his extremely clear suicide, which no one should investigate because it's such an open shut case. Yes. It's amazing what you can do, though, you're right, to whitewash your reputation. With some fairly large donation checks, that can
Steve Bannon. I just also want to Steve Bannon. I think also met with him.
Indeed.
Yeah. Sorry. I just always want to get as many people on the list as possible. Sorry. Go ahead.
Always time to connect more people to Epstein. That's
right.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing now. People may not realize this, but back in the 90s, like Bill Gates didn't have this sweet grandfatherly benefactor image. Like he had a reputation, you know, and deserve it, you know, based on his court testimony and the way it was exposed afterwards on the record. A real image as being a snotty, bullying, tyrannical monopolist, which is extremely accurate, I should say. It's not based on anything made up. You know, back in the 90s, of course, is when his company, Microsoft, had its very dramatic and drawn out antitrust trial, basically for monopolistic behavior, using its Windows operating system to take over other industries like web browsing and crushing the first web browser, Netscape. That put him in real, real legal trouble, like a major monopoly earning tens of billions of dollars. And I encourage people to go onto the YouTube and watch just the little highlight reels of Bill Gates' deposition from that 1990s trial. He is a smug, condescending bastard in that stuff. It's pretty ugly to behold. So at that time, he had that ugly reputation. As I point out in that piece for Jacobin, that is the period when he was looking like crap on TV every night because of that trial. That's the period when he made those big $10 billion odd donations to his foundation. And it really, really did succeed in steering the narrative away from his documented bullying, slamming his hand into his fist into his hand, saying, "We've got to crush our competitors," which I talk about in the book, was able to take all that off the front pages. And to this day, people now mainly associate him with this generous global benefaction he's associated with. So it can definitely go a long way. Yeah.
So let's spend a little bit more time in the 1990s, though. What did Bill Gates actually have to do? Because remember, this is the 1990s. We're deregulating everything. Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich are partnering up to get rid of almost every imaginable regulation on Wall Street, which is going to lead to the, you know, help set up the context for the crashes. There's the Silicon Valley bubble, the first tech bubble, which, you know, people forget, and it's, you know, it's obviously it's not as significant as what we're dealing with now or in 2008, but 2000, that was actually a pretty big bubble that burst. You know, Joseph Stiglitz even wrote the Roaring 90s. So my point is that in order to earn the attention of this is not the FDR Justice Department. This is not Johnson. This is not even, you know, maybe Nixon, frankly. This is a time where everything is getting deregulated. Clinton and Gore are bathing in corporate money of every type. And then, of course, on the other side, you have the Republicans literally just trying to wholesale privatize government under Gingrich. So how bad did Bill Gates need to be? And not just, you know, whatever, sure, be a competitive guy, fine, whatever. But specifically, how monopolistic do you have to be to get the serious attention of the Clinton Justice Department in the late 1990s?
Yeah, that's a really perceptive question, because the answer is a lot. Like, yes, you're right. It's not like the New Deal era of antitrust enforcement, when the Federal Trade Commission or the Department of Justice, you know, they share antitrust authority. They would spend years going after firms in court. And of course, here in the US, you know, it's not like the European Union, where the competition laws decide we're going to fine you and you're paying the fine. Here in the US, the government takes you to court and your corporation fights in court with its giant budget, you know. But even in that sort of framework, it's amazing what Gates and Microsoft are relatively well documented with doing. So, I mean, a number of corporate and Silicon Valley practices that the big platform companies now use all the time were pioneered by Microsoft in those days. And some of it is just based on the economics of this industry. Like I say in the book, BitTyrants, you look at these guys, you know, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, they mostly have monopolies in their big platform areas because of network effects. You know, when people want to share files or share video or make, you know, computer programs to run on our computers, you need a uniform platform, you need standardization. And so that tends to attract users to one dominant platform. It tends to make these markets more likely than usual to get monopolized. But the Justice Department economist staff recognizes that. They never go after firms for having a like network-based monopoly. It's monopolization, they call it in antitrust law today. Using your monopoly, for example, Bill Gates, Microsoft's Windows monopoly on computer operating systems, and then using that to take over some other market or some other company and monopolize that industry. And so Gates and Microsoft have this long history of this, again, literally slamming his fist into his hand, according to all of the biographies and corporate histories of Microsoft that you read. And people do, yeah, like that idea that, oh, you know, these guys here are the big competitors. They compete with one another to provide a good or service on the best terms. What people don't realize is these guys, they want to clear the field of competition. And once they beat one of their competitors, like, they take their market share, and now the firm is just that much bigger. So Microsoft, beyond those basic strategies, had all these really sleazy maneuvers. One they became famous for was when some company would arise in a marketplace related to computing, and Microsoft would realize that, you know, this firm could have a lot of success with their product. You know, they could become a competitor in the space. So what they would do is they'd send one of their representatives to approach this small company. Maybe it's developing network software or, you know, basic applications for you to use, whatever. And they'd say, you know, Microsoft, we're considering a similar product. We're interested in your project. Maybe we could partner, and we're gigantic, so that's a big deal for you. You should let our engineers look at your software code. And of course, as soon as their corporate engineers have looked at it, they then contact the firm again and say, we're no longer interested in working with you. We're about to roll out our very, very similar program of our own that's legally distinct, however. And now this stuff is kind of common in Silicon Valley, but that was a Microsoft innovation at that time. So plenty of big monopoly tactics were required to get the attention.
So then let's start talking about what Bill Gates actually did charitably. Is it true that his first, I mean, we'll get to the stuff that is much more uncritically accepted, which I'm actually very disturbed by. I'm sorry. I think it's quite disturbing that Bill Gates has an interest in population growth in Africa. I don't take that, you know, that's just not just like, oh, that's very altruistic. I think that that is something that should raise alarm bells if you know anything about anything. Or even just that, you know, and again, you don't need to go in some big conspiratorial direction. You just need to do a little bit of reading on the origins of the climate crisis or poverty in Africa as an example. But sorry to get on that digression. What about his role in schools in the beginning?
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Billionaires and the very, very wealthiest ever since the U.S. Gilded Age in the 1800s, you know, billionaires always want to do different things with their money. And sometimes they're more public charity inclined, like Carnegie or Gates today. But they always have this interest in education very enduringly, like shaping what young people learn. And would you believe it tends to be a picture of the world that accepts the existence of a super wealthy ruling class that decides what happens. What's true, of course, Gates has that long history here, and you know, his foundation's work in the developing world is its own issue. But here in the U.S., it's fascinating. I mean, the big focus, of course, is charter schools and independent schools. And what's interesting about these, I mean, there's a huge amount of variety. States and localities have a lot of different laws and a lot of different projects have gone through. What we tend to see is these are institutions that get public money. They do get the public funds from our tax assessments, but then the state and the public have very little role over the curriculum and what is taught in those schools. So we get public money, and then Bill Gates and figures that he hires set what the curriculum is and decide what we're going to learn. It's pretty icky. Yeah, it's not something that people are, the educators, I can tell you, are very excited about. There's a lot of exciting work where people are trying to organize the teachers in these schools who may or may not be part of the AFT or the other teaching unions. But that's a big focus of Gates' domestic charitable spending program there. And it's not very attractive in terms of what it does to the schools.
I'm also, I think that as of several years ago, that even inside the Gates Foundation itself, there was some acknowledgement that this relentless obsession on testing and charters and, you know, teacher performance, quote unquote, was actually, you know, not successful.
Doubtless. And anyone who's worked in education can understand that. You know, I mean, I don't teach K through 12. I teach college. I'm privileged. So I don't have to do the, those people are on the front lines, you know. But anyone, you know, many, many of my friends are in that primary education sphere. And they'll tell you that, like, the worst thing you can do is give kids more regimented, obviously testing oriented, but just very drill and memorization and rote recollection based education. Like, is this how you learn stuff? I mean, I took many standardized tests in the public school system growing up in the 80s and 90s, and I've forgotten large, large tracts of what I learned at that time because you're learning it for a test. You take the test, you forget it. You know, you remember things from school if they're actually taught in an interesting way, if you learn things that appeal to what you're actually interested in. I like to believe that there are some things you can do to really remember these things and for education to endure and for people to remember ideas. But having them memorize something and then spit it out on a test like a machine, it's a version of education that appeals to data-oriented technocrats like Bill Gates and figures around him because it gives you data and you can point to that and use that to justify taking control of the process away from the teachers, making them teach to test more. So it's something that definitely fits into their picture of education. I've yet to meet an educator who doesn't despise it.
Right. You also talk about how this fits. So there's obviously PR benefits to doing this. This would be the simplest advice that any crisis communications person could tell you. And again, let's be really clear here on numbers. Just the other day, Bill Gates, I think, is putting $50 million towards something towards, you know, corona research. I think he's worth $40 billion personally. So, you know, this is, you know, in a way the analog is, you know, I mean, look, I think if you have the ability and you want to, it's not a, you know, bad thing to give a couple of bucks to somebody who asks it on the street. I also don't think if you did a negligent homicide with your car, if you throw somebody 20 bucks, this is sort of that analogy, right? In terms of the overall damaging effects of the economy. So, but it's also a longstanding libertarian argument. When libertarians all of a sudden feel a need to say, no, we care about things too. We have a sense of altruism too. And the best thing is to take these wealthy people that we already kind of treat in this very weird, cultish, superhero way, very childlike way. Indeed. And their money, Bill Gates adjudicating where his money goes is better than just taxing them so everybody has healthcare, which seems obviously a lot more simple and efficient. But somehow that's not right because there's this. They have these special brains or whatever. So can you fit in the how that fits in with this broader market cult worship of these figures and how it undermines building a serious 21st century social safety net?
Yeah, right on. Absolutely. So, I mean, maybe the first thing to say about this is when I say, or as you repeated there, taking these foundations and they're giving as a PR exercise, that can sound very cynical to people. Like, oh, it's all just for the cameras, whatever. Like that can sound just sort of, you know, angry and recalcitrant. But the fact is, there is a record here, and the timing of Gates major donations to his foundation right when he's looking like crap during the antitrust trial is at least suggestive. But of course, no one's saying that charity isn't worth doing or that it's bad when some billionaire decides to launder his image by giving $10 million to some entity fighting malaria in the developing world. Charity is important, and we all personally should practice it for our much smaller parts, you know. But that's sort of the big thing. If you look at the dollars we're talking about, they're gigantic amounts to you and me, but compared to the scale of the need, they really are pretty modest. And indeed, in that Jacobin article, I was able to cite the woman who at that time was one of the heads of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And she said, our giving is a drop in the bucket compared to the government's role. Very reasonable, you know, like during that Ebola epidemic a couple years ago, ended up costing many $10 million to fight on a much smaller scale, obviously, than the COVID-19 we're coping with now. But at that time, the Gates Foundation gave an amount that was about 10% of that total cost. It's not that the amounts are negligible. It's just compared to what we're suggesting that a charity can handle, it's very small. As you said, you're right, libertarians will suggest, well, we'll have private charity to support the poor and people going through epidemics or natural disasters. And what they'll say is that way it's very, it's voluntary. Like the Ayn Rand Institute, I remember a couple of years ago during the after the Indian Ocean tsunami, which killed so many people in the Indian Ocean Basin, they put a big post up on their website saying the U.S. should not support tsunami victims, because that's not the government's money to give. How dare you tax millionaires and give some of their money to the most penniless people in the world after a disaster none of us can even picture? Let's say it's involuntary. Let Bill Gates voluntarily do it. And what they're assuming is exactly what you referred to, that the amounts that these guys will give are anywhere near the actual scale of what's required. And that tiny gesture he just made for COVID-19 that you referred to is a classic example. I mean, this thing will cost many tens of billions of dollars in the active campaign to fight it, let alone all the economic losses that we're still having come into view very scarily right now. So it's pretty modest numbers relative to the need. Right. But the bigger issue, which you sort of also referred to, is this puts so much more power in the hands of these wealthy figures and the foundations that they endow. You know, we're talking about figures who've been CEOs of some of the biggest corporations in the world. Microsoft's a $1 trillion company, or it was until the most recent market dive. It'll come back when the economy comes back one day. The amounts of money are tremendous. These companies are so big. These guys are very used to wielding a lot of power and bullying their subordinates. What we're seeing now is in this age of austerity, we're cutting taxes on these guys and cutting back on services to try to bring the budget in line. And now we say, all right, well, let these private actors fill in for the government's role. It puts this whole new tremendous lever of influence just right in their hands. So it's more than just, yeah, these guys are trying to make themselves look better and that they don't give nearly enough to deal with the problems in the face of the need. It's also, this gives them yet more authority on our over our society, as if they don't have enough as it is.
Yeah. Can you talk about that idea of authority and even the title of your book, Bit Tyrants? Like, how long and how hard is it going to be to disaggregate the idea of authoritarianism or tyrants or whatever from government and realizing that it can manifest itself essentially across any large bureaucracy? Government's capable of doing it, and not only are corporations capable of doing it, they're predicated on doing it. I mean, corporations are fundamentally undemocratic inside, let alone their broader effects on society if they're not ultra regulated or democratically controlled.
I think it's going to be very difficult because it's so ingrained. So it's true, when you talk to people politically about authoritarianism, more or less inevitably they're going to talk about state authoritarianism, and not without reason. I mean, we are, of course, before this crisis, we were living in a time of renaissance of authoritarianism. Trump and Bolsonaro and Modi, my God, terrible, terrible crypto fascist figures. So this is that's a very reasonable association for people to make. But it is true that people don't typically associate that with the marketplace. And just the reality is, once you're looking at trillion-dollar firms that employ tens of thousands of people or many more than that, like, those are straight, as you said, authoritarian environments. You know, you don't decide what you do at your job. Your boss decides. And perhaps you're a tech coder in the white collar workforce and you have a little bit more autonomy within the goals set for you by your boss. That's nice. Or maybe you're, you know, an Amazon warehouse coolie whose every second is directed by, you know, a device that you carry to track you more comprehensively. Like, the authoritarianism of the modern workplace is stunning. And it's, of course, only moving to new heights with this new technology. Talk about this, of course, elsewhere in the book, the ability of firms to track you outside your workplace and obviously in the work environment. There are real strides happening there. They're looking at implementing software that works through your computer camera.
Yep.
We'll track your eye movements. So you can see exactly when you're looking at email, exactly when you're looking at a spreadsheet. The invasive potential of this stuff is tremendous. Now, when the government does that, there'll at least be some pushback from libertarians, from public, you know, watchdogs. But when corporations do it, we go, oh, it's private property. They can do that. If you don't like it, move to the other monopolist employer in your town. You know,
right.
So it's pretty ugly. But I mean, to answer your question, I think it's tough. Like, after all, libertarian is the term for people who support the private sector and oppose the government. We use the word libertarian to describe people with some of the most authoritarian political opinions in the world. These people think Jeff Bezos should be free to fire you if you get pregnant. Right. Well, that's not really a libertarian position. But as I wrote in my last book, Capitalism versus Freedom, for Zero Books, who you know, it's that the presence of that authority in the workforce is tremendous. The ability of libertarians to act like it's not there, that I can't explain. I'm amazed by that.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the work in the developing world. It strikes me that on one hand, obviously, it's another area that just because of our, you know, half-baked colonial image of Africa as an example, it's always a great site for, I mean, that's the ultimate global site for reputation laundering and for do-goodery. You know, I cannot get, and the photos came out recently of the jet that took Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Clinton to Africa on this junket, and the opulence of the plane. And again, you know, folks should remember that this was not this wasn't like a kind of party flight or adventure. This was covered contemporaneously with sort of like, you know, hey, you know, mysterious billionaire Bill Jeffrey Epstein and, you know, freewheeling former president go and, you know, have a salon in the sky and go and help Africa. And, you know, obviously obscuring all of the horrors around Jeffrey Epstein's human trafficking network, but also not even attending to, you know, what were Bill Clinton's policies on the continent? What are these charitable moves regardless? Yes, of course, they can provide some good, But there's a bigger context around them. And I want to talk, I mean, specifically, yes, sure, it can do some individual good, but don't we have to ask even it, that if Bill Gates can undermine governance in the United States, right, which all billionaires have done, it's quite clear right now. I mean, somebody joked recently, said America's a third world country with a Gucci belt. And it's thanks to folks like this and these policies that we've pursued in, you know, the continent of Africa. There is enormous opportunity for folks to, you know, call shots, set policy, and I think, again, have a very, in my mind, very disturbing and misplaced fixation on population. So can we talk about, you know, Gates's work in that regard along all those lenses? What has it actually even accomplished? What are we really talking about here? And how does it affect the capacity of the continent to govern itself?
Oh, yeah, right on. So that really does get to the core of this issue. When we look at these foundations in the developing world, you know, what we used to call the third world, you know, Latin America, Africa, South Asia, broadly speaking. It's interesting because it's true. Like these foundations go there, and our governments too give these aid programs that they're very proud of to help these countries develop, you know, go through economic development so they're less poor, can industrialize, and have big middle classes like the developed world is the idea. Take a look at these countries. The amounts we give in aid, whether through foundations or through government spending, are pretty modest when you look at the scale of these countries' debt service. A lot of people don't realize this, but these countries that are the poorest in the world are some of the most heavily indebted countries in the world. And in particular, they owe their debt to entities outside of their national economies, too. Their bondholders, who are often, you know, big investment vehicles or investment banks in London and New York, who hold their bond, you know, their country's debts. And what people don't realize is this is what we call neocolonialism. These poor countries, back in 2010, I believe, the World Bank put the total debt, the outside debt of the developing world at $4 trillion, which when you compare it to the size of these countries' smaller economies is pretty stunning. So even though, you know, several hundred million dollars may flow from the European Union and USAID and foundation programs to the developing world, far larger amounts leave the developing world in the form of budget lines that are to pay the IMF, which is dictating their economic policy in order to sustain their access to credit markets. It's pretty ugly. But the way I always kind of put this in context for my students is, like, back at the end of World War II, countries like Brazil, India, the Congo, you know, these were seen as like poor countries then. Well, I mean, my God, it's been over 70 years since that conflict ended. They're still the poor countries, and they have much larger populations now, which Gates is concerned about. Like, that's a feature of their lack of development rather than needing some white savior to come in with a $10 million foundation check and look at me helping these poor, ignorant, not white people in their poor country. They just never heard of condoms and conception control, but now they have me, so...
And maybe I'll also undermine your ability to have, you know, I think the agricultural stuff is very disturbing, right? Like, this is actually, and you know, I know a certain type of nerd gets really triggered by this, but I, again, the issue with GMOs, I have no problem. Actually, you know, if people are concerned about the health of GMOs, I don't care. I'm sorry. You know, whatever. I know that triggers some people. I'm all for more research on everything, frankly. But the big core driving problem of how GMOs were deployed is that they were not coming from public research universities to improve crop yield or lower pesticide dependence. They were coming from major global agricultural conglomerates that want to treat agriculture the same way Microsoft treats IP. And that has a hugely damaging effect on small farmers and independent farmers in the United States, but even more brutally in a Kenya or in India. So there was this other component of, you know, just like the World Bank and IMF packages, that the strings that come along with this stuff and the policy mandates can really undermine self-sufficiency, local knowledge, and other profoundly important things for any type of democratic and equitable development. And, you know, it's just reported here as like, oh, look at Bill looking out.
It's true. And the GMOs piece is interesting. Yeah. So I come out of the sciences personally. My undergrad was in biology. Yeah. And so I'm naturally very in favor of scientific research along most lines. What I do always have to say to my, you know, secular science loving buddies is just remember, you know, it's not going to, you know, Nelson Mandela is not going to be in charge of it. They're some heinous agricultural corporation is going to get patents on these things, and they're going to use it as a tool to control the poorest people in society.
That was the political point. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. I've had this conversation. It's like drilling my head into a wall. It's like, yes, you know what? You put Lula in charge of Monsanto. Let's develop GMO technology.
That would be a totally different program.
Yes.
That's something I could get behind. Exactly. Right. It's interesting. It is just like the most recent wave of us twisting the agricultural economies of these countries. And again, many of them are predominantly still rural or agrarian societies, but they went through centuries of colonization where some European scumbags controlled their economy. And of course, there are 3,000 aspects to that. But one big piece of it, of course, was converting those countries, you know, regional agricultural production from production for local consumption over to producing cash crops. You guys aren't going to produce 30 different kinds of fruits and vegetables that sustains your traditional lifestyle and diet. You're going to produce tobacco or cotton now because that's a cash crop. We can export that back to the home country or to foreign markets and make a bunch of cash from that we can use to buy slaves or whatever god-awful agenda we have. So this is just the most recent wave of screwing with the agricultural economies of these societies. And it's a pretty ugly story, but it's that neo-colonial framework. These countries don't really have the ability to set their own economic policies because once they're in debt enough, mostly during the rule of some U.S.-backed dictatorship during the Cold War to fight the Soviets, we put in some general. The general does a bunch of cocaine and is corrupt and embezzles all the cash that they borrow. Now the countries have to pay it off. They can't meet their debts. So the IMF puts them into receivership and dictates economic policy to them. And the biggest thing that they usually want to cut at the IMF so that these countries can pay off their debts to rich people in the developed world. The IMF has them cut their budgets for education and public health. And right now, people are very concerned about public health in the developing world because it turns out their viruses can survive on planes and come to our nice country. It's terrible. Well, if we're concerned about this, a good place to start would be to have the IMF, which is largely run by the U.S. Treasury Department, have them stop putting public health programs in the developing world on the chopping block so we can pay off so that the government of Brazil or Argentina can meet some bond payment to some scumbags in the city of London or Manhattan.
Yeah, no, exactly. So big picture, it's important to tell the real story. It's important to call what Bill Gates is doing a racket. But in the overall, you know, and this is a theme, I would recommend everybody read Capitalism versus Freedom. That's also a fantastic book. I'd order it if you can. So what is the framework for democratizing technology, basically?
Yeah. To me, this is a really, really crucial question. Because as we've seen lately now, like these online platforms are so hugely important. And I was saying this before we all got stuck indoors and had no way to communicate with our friends and loved ones and work, except through using their products and their online platforms. These guys were hugely important prior to this. I've been telling people for a while, like right now, the five biggest firms in the world by market capitalization are Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Apple, and Facebook, those big five. And it's very unusual for the five biggest firms to all be from one sector of the economy. So these guys are huge going into this story. And now they're only being enlarged and entrenched by this crisis, you know. So the stakes of democratizing tech are really, really high. I think everyone can realize that. We're so obsessed with our phones. It sort of seems obvious. So what can we do? Well, traditionally, when you want to democratize or socialize a market, we talk about worker control. You know, worker control of the means of production, which I think is what we should always be, you know, striving for. Nationalizations or breaking up these companies like into smaller chunks, like smaller private corporations. These are legitimate moves. Senators Warren and Sanders during their sadly late presidential campaigns were proposing a lot of policies on these lines. It does show, again, I know we're all very bummed out about the end of the Sanders campaign recently. Like, it has shifted the national conversation in an enduring way. The movement is not over, everyone. Like, we can carry this forward. But looking at how we can try to socialize these platforms for our own part, to me, the biggest thing to realize is that we are a big part of the workforce of these firms. After all, like, these are platform firms. Their job is to provide a big online location where lots of users and creators come together. So for Bill Gates and Microsoft, it was the Windows operating system that programmers would make games or applications, and that would attract more users, that attracts more programmers through that network effect. So these giant platform companies like Facebook and YouTube, we're part of the workforce. Those are our goofy Facebook posts. Those are our weird YouTube videos. So there's a legitimate sense in which we are part of the workforce, and we should be part of an effort to socialize these platforms. Now, exactly what that means, I feel like we should use as many approaches as possible. These are new markets. You know, these are fast-changing times. We should be trying lots of different things in any sector that we're trying to democratize or socialize. But for our part, I think what we want to do is be learning about these platforms so we understand the economics behind them, and talking to our fellow users of these platforms and thinking about coordinated actions we can do, how we can organize one another, and then, you know, contemplate things like a YouTube strike where no one's going to watch YouTube for a day. Now, that's a pretty gigantic goal, I recognize. But these are the kind of things that we look at in the book. These are such important entities right now. Socializing them should be the first thing on our agenda, especially because we get so much information from them. Socializing them or steps in that direction would put a lot of ideas in other workers' heads too, I think.
Absolutely. Rob Larson, professor of economics at Tacoma Community College and author of the really important new book, Bit Tyrants, The Political Economy of Silicon Valley. His piece on Bill Gates' philanthropy giving is a racket, is in Jacobin. Everybody give it a read and buy the book. Rob, thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks for having me, man.
Of course. Take care. Stay safe. All right, folks, we are going to, you can just click leave meeting, Rob. All right, folks, we will get to the fun half in just a moment. A couple of things to announce. I wanted to, Matt, we don't still have that Teamsters thing handy, do we? The one we talked about on TMBS. Let me see. I wanted to give those guys another plug. I'm going to drop it in the chat. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, 1 second. All right. So before, while I'm looking for that, let me say, become a member of the Majority Report today. If you can, majority.fm/become a member. If you're watching this and you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel yet, well, do just that. Subscribe to the YouTube channel and get all. It's like an MR.
For MR, we crossed 800,000, I think, during this. I don't even know if we acknowledged it. Did we?
Oh, awesome.
So, yeah.
I believe that's it was amazing. Right, like the day before we broke for a remote studio setup.
Right.
That's hilarious. You know what? I'll do this. I'll get to this some other time. I can't find it at the moment, but I wanted to shout them out. I'll tweet it out. There's some very important projects to support right now, like these Teamsters in Philly, and also definitely the Amazon strike. I really hope that everybody at least this week is observing the Amazon strike. While workers at Amazon and Whole Foods are calling in sick. And it's also, by the way, if you listen to Chris Smalls, who's the organizer who got fired, and Amazon is attempting to, you know, run a PR campaign against, really disgusting stuff that you'd expect from a disgusting company led by disgusting people. It might even actually be a pretty good safety approach for yourself, because I'm not sure about if you listen to the workers, who I trust obviously more than the company. I think these Amazon warehouses are vectors.
You need to be thinking about this stuff, folks. I mean, people should watch the Chris Smalls interview we did on TMBS. But the thing is, it's like I tweeted this out a while ago, but when you see it happen to people around you, it makes it more real that bosses are making people come to work, and maybe it's gotten better now in most places. I'm not entirely sure in New York. But yeah. I know even in New York, they were late, that people were going to work for jobs that were going to lay them off 3 weeks later. So they were going to go to work while this pandemic's out there, while this virus is out there, bring it, expose it to everybody in their family, everybody that they love, and then they're going to get fired. So yes, like these are the conversations that really need to happen. And we need, frankly, 1,000 Chris Smalls. 2,000 yes. Chris Smalls, because
Chris Smalls is an extraordinary yeah. guy. Please watch the interview we do with him on TMBS. And more importantly, I'll retweet out the GoFundMe to support those workers. And don't order anything from Amazon for a week. It's a very easy ask. It's an extraordinarily easy ask, which we should all be following. It's extremely important right now. The most important thing that folks can do right now. Okay, we're not taking a break before the fun hat? Okay, sure. Become a member, if you can, of the Majority Report. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, or chocolate. On the Michael Brooks Show on Tuesday, Professor Richard Wolff was on. We talked the big picture, kind of macro dynamics. We did a reintroduction to the ideas of localism and resiliency. And then Chris Smalls, incredible interview that's also been clipped alone on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. So go over to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel, click subscribe, check out all of our illicit history docs. I'm really, really proud of those. And if you can, if you're able, people are jumping on right now to support the deals we're giving and to, you know, keep everything powering forward. Go to patreon.com/TMBS, become a member. This Saturday, Anna Kasparian and I are launching our new weekend show on Jacobin, which I'm really excited about. Go subscribe to the Jacobin YouTube channel. On Friday night at 6 o'clock on the Jacobin YouTube channel, I'm going to be doing a show, a seminar, basically, with Adolph Reed and others on the myth of the African-American vote and Bernie Sanders. Really excited about that. Subscribe to Jacobin. The YouTube channel is ramping up. And of course, and also if you want, go to Red Emma's independent bookstore, support them. It's great to help them out right now. And they were telling me that actually, folks ordering against the web, Cosmopolitan Answer to New Right is helping them out right now while the store isn't open. So I'm all about it. And, please, this is not strategic of me, but don't order my book on Amazon. If you're going to order my book, order it at Red Emma's. Danke. Jamie. Oh, you're not on yet, Jamie.
Oh, there we go. I was just saying, hell yeah. I've been to Red Emma's a number of times in Baltimore. I think it's really awesome. And I've known Colin, who helps run it, for a really long time.
So good guy.
Big endorsement from me.
Definitely.
Oh, right. All right. First time anyone's ever told me that in my life. So,
Jamie, talk.
You wanna know about the Antifada?
Yes.
I would love to tell you and everybody watching. So this week on the Antifada, we have a crossover episode with some of the very funny hosts of Trash Future, which is a good leftist podcast out of the UK. They talk about labor organizing at the end of the world. There's kind of an extended riff about the Chris Smalls situation. It's just like comically evil, the stuff that got leaked from that meeting. They're disgusting. Like, this guy seems poor and inarticulate. Let's smear him. Like, that's literally disgusting. What they said. And then when what's his name, Carney, got called out on it, he was like, I'm sorry, I've been going through a very emotional time right now. Like, union busting is now self-care. I don't know. Seems mm-hmm. bad to me. And they also go in hard on Toby Young, the terrible opinion columnist from the UK, as he weighs the lives of the British public against a feather and decides if they deserve to live or die to appease the great and powerful economy. Also, we did a Twitch yesterday after Majority Report. We've been experimenting with that at twitch.tv/TheAntifada. And that, I believe, is still up on Twitch for you to watch and will be out as a podcast soon. We talked about the end of the Bernie campaign and what's next for the movement, and also did some political economy because we had on The Line Goes Down, guys. And also, the main thing that I wanted to plug today is that I am going to be on the Street Fight Instagram Live tonight, doing a live stream with them. And cool. that is ephemeral. So if you want to see it, tune in at 7 o'clock to Street Fight WCRS is their Instagram handle. And it's WCRS because they are on the actual radio in Columbus, which is cool.
Awesome. Matt.
Yeah, literary hangover, folks. Afro-Ben's 1689 play, The Widow Ranter. It's about Bacon's Rebellion. On a previous episode of Literary Hangover, we talked about how John Washington, who is the original American colonist ancestor of George Washington, kicked off Bacon's Rebellion with a war crime. In this episode, we talk about how he got his fortune by marrying a widow that had a bunch of money from a previous marriage shortly after he came to Virginia.
Yes!
So check that out. Patreon.com/literary hangover, folks.
It's great. All right, everybody. Oh, and of course, check out the Nomi Key Show. She's going to join us in a little bit. Folks, we're going to take a break. We're going to go to the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.